Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions and calls. If you'd like to see our schedule, listen to past programs, sign up for the podcast, go to our website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. Back in the 1950s, when studies began to show that smokers were dying of lung cancer, cigarette companies launched a campaign to raise doubts about the evidence. The industry realized that if it could limit the debate to whether the science was accurate, they could avoid the bigger question, what to do about a product that was killing people. It wasn't long before other companies began using the same approach. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the lucrative world of product defense, and our guest for the program is David Michaels. He is research professor and associate chairman in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, and he is the author of a book that we will talk about. The title of his book is Doubt Is Their Product: How Industry's Assault on Science Threatens Your Health. The book is published by the Oxford University Press. I'm sure you could find it in the bookstore, the library, if you'd like to read it. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about our guest in addition to his teaching and research at the George Washington University. He also holds faculty appointments at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and also at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He directs the Project on Scientific Knowledge and Public Policy that brings together scientists to examine the use and misuse of science in two forums where public policy is shaped, in the courts and also in the regulatory arena. He served as the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Environment, Safety, and Health from 1998 until January of 2001. He was the chief architect of the historic initiative to compensate workers in the nuclear weapons complex who developed cancer or lung disease as a result of their exposure to radiation, beryllium, and other hazards. Since that came into being in 2000, the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program has provided more than $1 billion in benefits to sick workers and their families. In 2006, of February, he received the American Association for the Advancement of Science Scientific Freedom and Responsibility Award for his work on behalf of nuclear weapons workers and also for his advocacy of scientific integrity. And we're pleased to have him with us this morning. He's joining us by phone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, certainly you are invited to call. Dr. Michaels, hello.
Hey, David. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Thanks. And you?
Very well. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. And I guess here, the bottom line, we can talk about a number of particular cases here, perhaps beginning with what was the industry that set the pattern for this, which was tobacco, even though previous industries had taken a kind of a similar approach to questions about whether things that they manufactured were hazardous or not. But it seems that the argument that you're making is that certainly from the point where the Surgeon General issued his report and people started talking seriously about the dangers of cancer, this kind of approach that the tobacco industry took now seems to be the standard approach that virtually any industry, if it has a product that's judged to be unsafe or is suspected to be unsafe, now everybody essentially does the same thing, and that is attack the research that points to the problem.
That's right. And the objective is to gain a few more years. Eventually, the science gets sorted out. And in most cases, the industry has to either withdraw the product or make sure people who are exposed to it are protected. But in the short run, by attacking the science, they get a few more years of selling a product without having to put any controls in the production processes or to warn people.
And this is something that we've seen over and over again. Maybe just to go back a little bit before the 1950s, before we talk about the tobacco industry, it does seem to be the case that other industries, when there was a problem about products that they manufacture, or maybe the issue here was industrial exposure of workers to hazards, that it seems that this kind of questioning that is saying, well, we're not really sure what's going on. We're not really sure it's the product. That kind of thing indeed goes back certainly before 1950.
Exactly. And probably the most well-known example, of course, is the asbestos industry that denied both the studies in humans showing that asbestos exposure caused lung cancer, but also really attempted to hide some of the animal studies that confirmed that same information. And it was also an issue with what I write about is the lead industry, which was concerned not just about workers, but in fact, the lead industry was quite concerned because there were plenty of reports that children were being poisoned by lead, and that would pressure the industry to pull lead out of both paint and gasoline. And the industry was able to keep lead being sold in those products for much longer than it should have. In fact, the U.S. finally forced lead out of gasoline really in the 1970s, at which point the levels of lead in our air started dropping very precipitously because, you know, gasoline was no longer leaded. And there's been a concurrent rise in the IQ of children, which is clearly related to the fact that they're not being exposed to that much lead. Mm-hmm. And so that's been really one of the great public health triumphs. It was many years in coming. It was far too late. But removing lead from gasoline over the objections of the lead industry has had a terrific, you know, positive impact on our health and also on human development.
Yeah, that's one of those things when you have to recognize that the hazard posed by lead was something that people had known about for a long time, or at least had good reason to suspect. And how was it that this industry managed to continue to spin it and say, well, we're really not sure?
Well, the first thing they did was they would go after the studies where kids who were generally poor kids who had all sorts of other problems would report to emergency rooms with severe lead poisoning, and they clearly had, you know, a terrible impact on them in lots of ways. And the lead industry would always discount those claims, saying, well, those are just poor kids and they've got the problems of being poor. It took a long time before science could show that any kid exposed to lead actually had a detrimental impact on the kid. And even with, you know, in those studies, which were much more subtle and showed that relatively low levels of lead exposure impacted kids' health and impacted their neurological development and their intellectual development, the industry was able to say, you know, those complicated methods, we just don't buy them. They demanded the raw data. They tried to attack the researcher who did a lot of that work, a guy named Herb Needleman. And they did everything they could to essentially discredit those studies, which are now widely accepted. I mean, there's no debate at all in the scientific community about the effects of low levels of lead exposure on kids. But they pulled out all their guns, and they hired scientists to go after the scientists who were reporting these findings they didn't like. And that's the same pattern we see over and over and over again. Mm.
Well, in that particular case, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the government response. You could imagine that people in government might say, well, what we're going to do is, if we're making a mistake, we're going to err on the side of public safety.
No, it tends to be the opposite, because the way our regulatory system is set up is the government has to show pretty clearly that you know, the effect, the changes that they're going to force on industry will be positive. And industry can always go to court and say, look, there's some question in the science. How can you make us clean up? How can you make us reduce exposure when there's uncertainty in the science? In fact, Congress passed all the laws that are used to protect us, the Clean Air Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, knowing that regulatory agencies have to use the best evidence available. And we're never absolutely sure. But because we as Americans believe, you know, science is looking for the truth, science will tell us exactly what we need to know. When there's uncertainty and when there's differences between scientists, the instinct of the government and also of the courts is to say, wait a minute, let's step back. And that gives these polluting industries a couple more years to do what they want. And what I show in the book, and I have a lot of documentary examples of this, is the internal papers of industries which say exactly this. One of my favorites is a memo written by Hill and Knowlton, the public relations agency that did a lot of work for tobacco, when they're talking about the work that they did for other industries. And they talk about their work around Freon, what are called chlorofluorocarbons, which are the aerosol propellants that were associated in the 1970s with an increasing hole in the ozone layer. When those studies started coming out and the government moved toward, you know, banning Freon, DuPont, the major producer of Freon, hired Hill and Knowlton. And as Hill and Knowlton writes, they hired us to get a couple of more years of selling it before we could essentially get a replacement product. Mm. And they were able to do that. Now, the scientists who did the initial work, they got the Nobel Prize. The science was very good. But Hill and Knowlton was able to get DuPont a couple of more years of selling the stuff, and the ozone layer got that much bigger over those years.
Yeah, one of the things that's remarkable to me is that someone would actually commit that to paper, just like the famous quote that you take for the title of the book, where you quote this man. It was someone who was working for the tobacco industry, and he literally said that. He said, "Doubt is our product." "Doubt is our product since it's the best means of competing with the quote body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public." So it clearly that he was on record saying, yeah, this is the strategy. We think that if we can create enough doubt in people's minds, sort of muddy the waters enough, that the fact that there is good evidence to believe that there is a hazard posed by smoking, and you can generalize that to other things, that, you know, it'll muddy the waters enough so that nothing will happen.
No, that's right. I was also astounded on a regular basis that people put these materials in writing. So what I've done is I've actually put every reference and every document in the book up on the website, defendingscience.org. And so anyone who reads the book, or even those who don't, can go onto that website. They could pull down these smoking gun documents and read them and reprint them and see exactly what these executives and what these scientists are saying.
And I should very quickly introduce again our guest, David Michaels. He's the author of the book, Doubt Is Their Product, How Industry's Assault on Science Threatens Your Health. It's published by the Oxford University Press. He is an epidemiologist. He's director of the Project on Scientific Knowledge and Public Policy at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. And during the Clinton administration, he served as Assistant Secretary of Energy for Environment, Safety, and Health. He was responsible for protecting the health and safety of workers, neighboring communities, and also the environment surrounding the nation's nuclear weapons facilities. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, it seems that, as we said, that this industries had used this approach before the 1950s, but it seems that the industry that really show other industries how it's done was the tobacco industry. Can you talk a little bit about how it is that they approached this, the evidence at the time that was becoming more and more apparent that there was this close link between smoking cigarettes and lung cancer?
That's an interesting question, David, because there were two different sort of responses during different historical periods. The first, starting in the 1950s, was essentially saying, we need more research, that this, you know, we're just not sure, this new field of epidemiology isn't very convincing. You know, there were five studies published in 1950, all linking cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And in fact, when you go back and look at those studies, it's all pretty clear, and there shouldn't have been debate after that. But the tobacco industry hired John Hill, the founder of Hill & Knowlton, and they sort of essentially tried to raise questions. They didn't do their own research, but what they did was they said, anything that suggests lung cancer is not associated with cigarette smoking, or cigarette smoking maybe causes, you know, can't really cause lung cancer because the study is bad, or whatever it is, they will publicize that study. They even had their own journal called Research in Tobacco and Health, or Smoking and Health, which they would reprint anything which suggested tobacco wasn't the cause of lung cancer or later heart disease. And that worked for a while, but one of the reasons it worked is they just had to raise questions, but also they could have an underlying argument. Well, even if this stuff does cause lung cancer, individuals are making a choice. Mm-hmm. And as long as it's the individual's choice, you know, we don't have to really do anything about this toxic product. That changed in the 1980s and 1990s. When studies began to show that it wasn't just smokers who were getting sick from smoking, but non-smoking spouses who were exposed to secondhand tobacco smoke, people who work in areas where there's a lot of cigarette smoke, like flight attendants. At that point, the choice argument went out the window, and the tobacco industry really had to do a much better job of going after the science, and so they hired much better scientists, or much more articulate scientists. And they would essentially demand the raw data from any study that showed secondhand tobacco smoke was associated with lung cancer. They'd demand the raw data. They would try to reanalyze it. They poured millions and millions of dollars into trying to pull apart any study that showed for example, that a non-smoking spouse was at increased risk of lung cancer. That work was really very sophisticated. It's those scientists who cut their teeth working for tobacco who've now gone on to work for many different industries doing exactly that same sort of work. And one of the things I try to document in the book is these same people who, you know, here's the work they did for the tobacco companies, you know, going after studies showing that, you know, non-smoking spouses are getting sick. They then went to the chromium industry 3 years later and said, here's what we can do for you, or here's what we did for the beryllium industry, and showing the same people with the same documents over and over again.
And they were very upfront in going to the companies and saying, look, here's what we can do for you. We can make it possible at the very least for you to continue to manufacture the products or use the same manufacturing processes you're doing now, or, you know, whatever it is. We can say, well, at least for the short term here, you can just keep on doing what you're doing.
Right. No, I have minutes from meetings of trade associations. The trade association called the Chrome Coalition, which are companies involved in chrome plating and making chrome pigments, who are facing increased regulation because their product, chromium, causes lung cancer. And there's no question. In fact, we've known also for more than 50 years it's a powerful lung carcinogen. And the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has not regulated it as a lung carcinogen, so workers are exposed to levels that are far too high. And as it became clear that some new regulation was coming down the pike, the Chrome Coalition, this trade association, put out a request for help, and I have the minutes for the meetings where these same scientists who worked for tobacco said, we will get the studies being done by these agencies and pull them apart. We will create new manuscripts and publish them in the scientific literature attacking some of the old studies. And we will do what we can to make sure OSHA doesn't issue a stronger standard.
You know, this is, I suppose this is a slightly different question, but it does come to mind, and that is, given what we know about the hazards of tobacco use, either firsthand or the kind of exposure that people get secondhand, why is it that now, at this late date, 2008, it's essentially a virtually unregulated product?
Well, it's pure political power. Also, I think people, you know, the tobacco industry has figured out exactly how to fend off regulation. But what's interesting now is, given the tobacco industry no longer debates the question of whether it causes lung cancer, in fact, they've all acknowledged it, what the big companies have done and what Philip Morris has done has said, we want regulation now. Because, in fact, companies know that usually they can live with regulation, and Philip Morris has asked the FDA to step in, or actually has asked Congress to pass legislation that giving the Food and Drug Administration the ability to regulate tobacco, not to ban it. And the legislation, which Philip Morris had a hand in writing, says very clearly, you can't ban the material, but you can do certain things to control it. Philip Morris has realized that by getting government regulation now, they will control the market and stop any new companies from getting into it. I mean, I think it's quite cynical.
Let's talk about the beginnings of the age of regulation. This was, we're talking about here, the early 70s, when some of the agencies that we now know well, like the Environmental Protection Agency and the Occupational Safety Health Administration and the Consumer Product Safety Commission, all these things came into being. And interestingly enough, you know, depending on how you feel about Richard Nixon, it is sort of noteworthy that this was, in fact, the Nixon administration under which some of these things came to be. Now, also, you could say their motives were sort of complex and not so clear-cut as we might think. But in any case, what was going on at this time that finally got to the point where these kinds of oversight agencies began to be created?
Well, I think a lot of it was the environmental movement, really, with Earth Day and people recognizing that at that point the environment that most Americans lived in was simply getting worse and worse. And we had cities where it was very difficult to see the sun on many days. We had rivers like the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland catching fire. That pushed Congress, and it was very much bipartisan, and Richard Nixon signed all these laws, to essentially create strong regulatory agencies that would use the best available science to reduce exposures and protect the public's health and environment. And the first years, those regulatory agencies really did a good job, and the results are very clear. I mean, we have far fewer or far lower levels of pollutants in our air now than we did 30 years ago. I mean, it's been a great success. But in many ways, that's being turned around. The polluting companies have figured out exactly how to approach these agencies and how to stymie them from moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And how do they do that?
Well, they've essentially they know that essentially that decisions have to be made on the basis of science, and if they can create a credible looking body of evidence that contradicts the science the agency is using, it essentially throws everything into question. Now, what's interesting, I was a regulator. In the Energy Department, I was in charge of protecting the health of workers and the environment and the communities around the nation's nuclear weapons complex. Everybody in our unit, and this is true across the federal government, knows when they receive these studies from industries that they're just nonsense, that these are sort of manipulated studies, and we try to discount them. But what happens is they're introduced, and we get a lot of letters saying they have to be used. And congressmen who are close to those industries call the agency and say, did you see this study? And the agency knows that if whatever regulation they put out will be taken immediately to court, and the polluting companies will say, well, you didn't take these studies into account. And the idea, as I said before, is to slow things down. In the long run, eventually, if an agency wants to protect the public, they'll be able to do that. But it could take 5 years or 10 years longer as a result of that. In fact, there's one document I have in there. There's a group called the Weinberg Group, which is a very big product defense company in Washington. They did a tremendous amount of work for tobacco. On their website, before I started writing about this, were case studies talking about the work that they were able to do. And I saved screenshots of all their boasts, and I put them up on our website. They've, of course, removed them. But they describe how the Food and Drug Administration announced that they were going to remove a drug from the market. Now, the FDA removes a drug from the market for one of two reasons only. The first is that the drug simply doesn't work. The second is that the FDA has decided that the risks of the drug outweigh the benefits. And there have to be, those risks have to be very serious for the FDA to try to remove a drug. Well, the Weinberg Group boasted that when the FDA announced this process and tried to remove a drug from the market, the Weinberg Group spearheaded the defense and was able to slow the agency down for 10 years before the agency finally was able to force the drug off the market. So for 10 years, people were either, there was a drug being sold that either didn't work or that its risks outweighed the benefits. And I don't know what the drug is. I haven't been able to find out. But that's, you know, it's a delay is what they want. And, it's, you know, they know how to do it, so they can get those years.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, David Michaels, again, his book is titled Doubt is Their Product, How Industry's Assault on Science Threatens Your Health, published by the Oxford University Press. He is director of the Project on Scientific Knowledge and Public Policy at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. And as we've mentioned, I mentioned during the Clinton administration, he was Assistant Secretary of Energy for Environment, Safety, and Health, and was responsible for protecting the health and safety of workers of neighboring communities and also the environment surrounding the nation's nuclear weapons facility. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you might just talk a little bit more about the what you call the product defense industry.
Well, it's their own phrase, though, of course, since I've started writing about it, that's changing too. But what a number of these companies have realized is that they can make money defending products in both in courts and in the regulatory world. Now, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, this same work was done by public relations companies like Hill and Knowlton, who used scientists. But I think the scientists realized they could make a lot more money by doing this work themselves, and so they've set up their own companies, some of which are big enough they're publicly traded. And essentially what their job is to defend the product, and they say it very explicitly. Though in the last month or two, the Weinberg Group has changed their website from saying product defense to product support, because product defense really illuminate the work they were doing. Because I don't believe products need defense. I think people need to be protected. The environment needs to be protected. And we have to consider whether or not a product is a dangerous one in terms of human health or the environment. But the product itself should have no right to defense.
We have a caller here. I'm sure we'd have some others, but we'll start in here with someone who is in Urbana on our first line, line number one. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Michaels. A phrase you always hear, it's a big cliche in this area, is someone must be given the benefit of the doubt. So the tactic apparently is to create some doubt and then to say that someone else must be given its benefit. Unfortunately, our dominant philosophy of science says that no scientific result is ever absolutely and perfectly certain. There will always be some doubt about its ultimate truth. And you're saying that some people are able to exploit that theoretical kind of doubt and use it in their PR and propaganda. How do you deal with the cliche of someone must be given the benefit of the doubt?
You raise a very important question, and this is sort of the underlying philosophical question.
I'll ring off.
All right, well, thanks for
thank
the question.
Thank you for calling. The presumption of innocence is actually something that comes up in a lot of these memos I write about. One of these groups has a PowerPoint presentation saying, there should be a presumption of innocence. And actually, the examples they use, of course, are tobacco and asbestos, which are not the least bit innocent. But we don't need to grant toxic products, or any products, a presumption of innocence. That's something that the Constitution has given to individuals, of course. There's a great reason for that. But science doesn't give us the complete answers, and certainly not in the time framework we need. The global warming is the best example. We have lots and lots of models that suggest that with increased burning of fossil fuels, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will rise, temperatures will rise, and there will be all sorts of consequences of that. Now, that may or may not happen. Many people believe it's likely to happen. We certainly can't wait to be absolutely sure that it will happen. The only way to be absolutely sure it happens is to measure it after it has happened, and that will be too late. We have a regulatory system whose object is to protect people from getting sick or being exposed to toxic chemicals or from destroying the environment before the effects occur. And, of course, that throws out the idea of the presumption of innocence of toxic chemicals. But if you bring up that argument, essentially that cliche, giving the chemical the presumption of innocence or the benefit of the doubt, you then essentially put people at risk. And so that's exactly the issue that has to be taken on philosophically.
Well, this is interesting here in another way, and again, it sort of goes to this practical matter that in science, maybe nothing is ever completely certain, or there's always going to be some question about whether your conclusion is correct. And this has to do with the Supreme Court decision of 1993. This is Daubert v. Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals. Maybe you could talk about what that has meant for people who are trying to pursue claims in court.
Yeah, there was a very important decision the Supreme Court issued in 1993. It's called the Daubert decision, which essentially requires federal judges to be gatekeepers. They have to consider the evidence being brought into a court as to whether it's reasonable and reliable, and it's their job to decide whether or not a jury should be able to hear it. The reality is if a judge decides that the evidence being brought in, the scientific evidence, is not reasonable, is not relevant or reliable and throws it out, that's usually the end of the case, and the jury never actually hears the case. The problem it's raised is that federal judges, for the most part, have little understanding of science and little background science. And so they're being asked to consider whether or not certain evidence, should ever be used in a case. And some judges simply make the wrong decision, make bad decisions. It's, the decision was an important one in that certainly there was a lot of bad science getting into court. And the courts said, well, how do we make sure all this bad science doesn't get in? But they've essentially forced judges to play the role as gatekeeper, and they're not qualified to do that. It's had a number of negative impacts. It's interesting. It's actually probably pretty insidious. What's done is in many of these suits around toxic chemicals, it's forced the plaintiffs to hire better and more expensive experts to make sure that the judge couldn't rule them their testimony to be not relevant or reliable. And so it's raised the court costs tremendously when people go into court to sue. And what I've been told by numerous law professors and attorneys is that because these cases have become so expensive, if someone doesn't have a very strong case, or if they have an injury that isn't worth that much money, it's a very crude measure. If someone says, well, your lungs have been damaged, but it's not worth $1 million, they'll never get a lawyer to take the case because the lawyer won't be able to afford to pay, expensive experts a lot of money to be used in the court case. And so it's really shut people out of the courtroom. And it's, I think, in that way, an issue of injustice.
Let's also, I want to give you a chance to talk about the Data Quality Act.
Well, that's an interesting thing. That's the Bush administration has implemented a number of essentially requirements on regulatory agencies that have slowed them down and have given primarily polluting companies and manufacturers of dangerous products the ability to essentially constrain these regulatory agencies. And that's been done through a very obscure piece of legislation called the Data Quality Act, which actually was thought up by the tobacco industry and pushed by the tobacco industry's lobbyists because they were going after regulation around secondhand smoke. But it's been used by the Bush administration, essentially, to allow any party to question any science used by an agency. And it's as a result of that, a lot of very important government reports really have never seen the light of day. The there's a group called the National Toxicology Program, which is supposed to issue on an annual or biannual basis a report on carcinogens, an annual report, federal government report on the chemicals that cause cancer. And we're 4 years now since the last report was issued because the agency has to figure out a way to deal with the Data Quality Act. It's very insidious, and it will have an impact long after the Bush administration is gone.
And this was something, perhaps this happens in Washington, that was slipped into a much larger piece of legislation. That, you know, the question is how many of the members of Congress who voted on this actually knew that it was there?
Oh, very few. It was a couple of paragraphs in, a 700-page appropriations bill. It's a rider, so there was never open discussion about it. Which are these appropriations bills are supposed to only last a year, but people slip these things in that then can be essentially adopted by the administration and last for a long time. If the Bush administration wants to treat this differently, they could have. But essentially what they've done is what I call institutionalizing uncertainty. They've used this as an opportunity to build this structure that will slow down regulatory agencies into the future.
You've talked about so many industries have this sort of strategy that if they have a product, or maybe it's something that they use in manufacturing a product or a process, something like this that looks like it's hazardous to people who work in that industry or to people who use the product, that what they're going to do is they're going to take the strategy that says we will attack the science, the studies that show that there is a hazard, and what they do, and then what they will do is they can go out and get their own scientists to do studies that will challenge or come up with a different sort of result. And then what they will do is they will say, well, you know, there's bad science and there's good science, and of course to them the good science are the studies that show what they want to show, and the bad ones are the ones that they don't like and they're trying to disagree with. And so that's where someone somewhere along the line coined the term junk science as a way of dismissing studies that come up with conclusions that you don't like.
That's exactly right. The junk science, there's a guy who calls himself the junk man. He's on Fox News and he's got a website and he lists all the junk scientists that he doesn't like. Of course, I forget the numbers are offhand, but you know there are four or five Nobel Prize winners on that list, number of people who've gotten the top awards in their fields. But any science they don't like gets called junk science.
And I wonder whether, in fact, this ends up, one of the results is to, in the mind of the public and your average people, to question all of science and say, well, do scientists really know? Do they ever know when they tell you something? Are they really sure? Can we trust any sort of scientific study about anything?
Right. We don't want scientists to essentially be attacked like the accountants who worked for Arthur Andersen Company, you know, helping Enron skirt the law. And that's really what happened to accountants. They thought, well, here was an upstanding profession, but it turns out there are a number of black sheep in that profession who are essentially helping companies, you know, rip off the public, rip off their workers and the pension plans. There's a cynicism that comes with that, and we're certainly seeing people look at scientists the same way, and it's quite dangerous for science, and I think as a result, dangerous for progress.
And I think, you know, it goes to an issue that I'm sure people have pointed out before, and that is that people, I think, don't really quite understand what scientists do, how it is they attempt to learn about the world, to answer various questions, and how it is that they look at this question of certainty, and how sure can we be today what we say we know that that's the way it is.
That's right. And then piled onto that is the issue that scientists who are paid by universities and the federal government always have to take on new areas. The federal government has very little interest in revisiting old areas or looking at, for example, there's a lot of controversy now over the health effects of exposure to asbestos from brake shoes.
Mm-hmm.
the industries that made brake shoes and the auto industry has been sued a number of times, and so they've paid for some of these very mercenary scientists to create studies showing that asbestos from brake shoes is not dangerous. There are no studies being done by independent scientists because it's not really of any public health interest. Asbestos has very much been controlled. There's a limited amount of federal money for studies of environmental exposures, and certainly not going to go to asbestos because we've already spent hundreds of millions of dollars studying asbestos. And so all the new studies that are being done by product defense scientists, and they're really questionable studies, but there's no, you know, they dominate the literature. It's also worth noting, though, that many of the scientists who work for corporations are upstanding scientists with great integrity. They're not the ones brought in when there's a crisis. When you have some court cases and a product that your company has made has been implicated in people getting cancer or otherwise sick, the companies rarely look at their own scientists for studies. They go to these outside firms. It's like hiring the fancy outside lawyer when you have a real problem. It's the same thing. You find these product defense scientists. They're the ones who can create and quickly publish studies that will defend the product, and they'll be willing to testify and do all the regulatory work that they need. And unfortunately, this ends up tarring good scientists working for these companies as well. It's really a very unfortunate development, I think.
Yeah. Just to we were talking a little bit earlier about the Data Quality Act. That was something that and tying into this issue of threats of asbestos exposure to people who work on brakes. There, in fact, the EPA had a publication addressing this and trying to make sure the people who did that kind of work knew about the potential hazard. And it was something that the industry used the Data Quality Act to challenge it. And then, in fact, the EPA withdrew the publication, so it's not available anymore.
That's right. Now, the industry, which was being sued, forced EPA to withdraw the publication, and they went through a long process involving all sorts of outside reviews, and eventually they were able to put out another brochure, which is quite a good brochure, but it took 3 or 4 years where nothing was available. And that's, so they were successful. During those years, there was no material out there, and as a result of that, there were no EPA materials that could be used in any of these court cases or in these regulatory moments. And that's always their objective.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Michaels. He is a research professor and associate chairman in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. He also holds faculty appointments at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and he is the author of the book Doubt Is Their Product, How Industry's Assault on Science Threatens Your Health. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Oxford University Press. During the Clinton administration, he served as the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Environment, Safety, and Health. That was from 1998 through 2001, and in that position, he had primary responsibility for protecting the health and safety of workers, of neighboring communities, and also the environment surrounding the nation's nuclear weapons facilities. Questions welcome. We have a couple of ready to go, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in late, so you may have covered this, but how do you factor in the recent guilty pleas and sentencing of a major tort firm such as Milberg and the guilty verdicts for some of the partners, Melvin Weiss, etc., the difficulties with Dick Scruggs in Mississippi, another tort attorney, and the general finding by the courts that there's large-scale legal fraud in asbestos and silicosis cases and in general tort law, that essentially the attorneys are setting up fake cases, setting up fake science, and essentially winning against the industry because of this legal fraud. I mean, I could go into detail.
No, I certainly follow that, and I think you raise a very good point. I think wherever there's a great deal of money around, it attracts people who are unethical. And certainly, you've raised two examples of, unethical or actually illegal behavior, and hopefully those people will be punished. But that doesn't negate the importance of lawsuits in protecting the public health. And actually, that's something I write about a lot, that as a result of the Bush administration's unwillingness to issue any regulations at all to protect the public, lawsuits end up being the only means to force essentially lowering exposure to some of these toxic chemicals. It's doubly unfortunate then that there are these unethical characters who are playing in that field, because it really tars all of them. But an example I write about is this chemical called diacetyl, which is an artificial butter flavor. And it's killed a number of workers in microwave popcorn factories and flavor factories. This is a chemical that, you know, when you breathe it in fairly not such high levels, causes a catastrophic lung disease. And there are dozens of workers around the country who have gotten sick. OSHA has, well, for many years, OSHA refused to do anything, even though this was an open and shut situation where you had workers in plant after plant developing this very rare illness. And I wrote about this and spoke about this and finally helped some unions petition OSHA so they would issue a standard, but OSHA just wouldn't do anything. On the other hand, the flavor industry stepped in and said, we have to protect workers. In fact, they asked OSHA as well to issue a standard. The reason for that is there's been already more than $100 million in lawsuit settlements and awards against flavor manufacturers for making this stuff, which has destroyed these people's lungs. So the lawsuits essentially pushed the industry into doing the right thing. And both the industries and the unions are trying to drag OSHA along to do the right thing, and unfortunately it's hard to do that.
But the cases that were found, it was over 30 years, so it has nothing to do with the Bush administration, the Milberg and Weiss issues, and they said over 165 suits, in other words, court cases that were fraudulent. There were major, you know,
These are investor suits. I'm not writing about investor. This is all. You're talking about suits involving investors. I'm talking about public health suits.
Not just investors. It had to do with all sorts of.
I think you're.
Asbestos, silicosis, all sorts of other.
My understanding is these Milberg cases have nothing to do with asbestos or silicosis. So I appreciate your concern, and I share your. I think if these guys did something illegal, as obviously they did, they should go to jail. But that doesn't, negate the importance of these suits in protecting the public, because no one else is doing it.
We only have about 5 minutes left, and I have one more caller here, and I hope that the caller would forgive me if I want to go on, because I want to include this caller before we end up out of time. This is Champaign County, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Very well done. I think the point about Milberg is this is really a digression. There's so many other examples. Could you generally talk about the idea of the precautionary principle? It sort of came up almost a little bit ago when you were talking about the idea that it's now certainly sort of run as if, it was a court of law, a criminal case where you had the presumption of innocence. And the precautionary principle says that we should have a presumption of it may be dangerous, and we should consider that.
That's right. I think it's very important not to fall into sort of the simplistic precautionary principle, but the basic idea is that we have to look to see what the possible risks are of not doing anything or of essentially allowing these exposures. And if we don't know, we should certainly be very cautious. We should take precautions and not allow, exposures unless we have some understanding that might be safe. You have to look at it in a very complex way, because I think it's you certainly have to consider what the range of possible effects are. And, when you're dealing with global warming, for example, and you're thinking about, the effects could be catastrophic, you have to look at it very differently than something that, as far as we understand, could only cause sort of minor damage. And we have to think about what the potential risk we're facing by proceeding along a track of, say, allowing this chemical to be used. But the basic idea of reversing the presumptions is a very good one, that we should be considering, should this product be allowed into the market? Now, we have some laws that essentially use that presumption, but they're weak, and they only are for new chemicals. So when a manufacturer has a new chemical that they want to market, they have to file some papers with the Environmental Protection Agency under something called the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA. And the EPA considers it, and they've actually told manufacturers many times, you can't use this chemical, or you have to do more tests, in which case usually the manufacturer goes for a new chemical. And so that basic idea is actually in law, and one we should be using probably much more widely. It doesn't cover, though, all the materials, the thousands of chemicals that are already on the market that were grandfathered in.
What is the acronym or the expression for that, generally regarded as safe?
Well, that's a different thing. The generally regarded as safe concept is something that the Food and Drug Administration uses, where they say if we've done some tests and something doesn't look like it's dangerous, we'll call it generally regarded as safe, and you don't even have to list it on the label. Essentially, you're allowed to use it. Unfortunately, it's some of the things that we are on that list we know are not safe, and so they probably have to be revisited. But going back to the precautionary principle for a minute, the Europeans have embraced that concept much more than we have and have passed legislation called REACH, which is the registration, I forget the exact what the acronym means, but essentially it's forcing manufacturers of chemicals to do more testing on the chemicals that are in use. And what's good about this is we will be the beneficiaries of this as much as the Europeans, because every major chemical company in Europe sells in the United States, and every American company sells in Europe. And if you want to sell in Europe, which is as big a market or bigger a market than the United States, you're going to have to go through this testing. So we'll actually learn something about some of these chemicals. And hopefully some of the bad ones will be identified early and pulled. And it's a very positive step forward. We are way behind the rest of the world in approaching this.
One other thing, are the idea of a slap suit, are those still being, are those still ubiquitous?
They're certainly happening. These are suits essentially to harass people who are causing problems in some cases for big corporations. And we hear about them, we see them. I'm not an attorney, so I don't follow them too carefully, but I certainly hear about them happening.
Well, thanks very much. I hope we can do something about this.
Thank you.
We're down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. You have some suggestions in the book for improving the regulatory process. We don't have enough time to talk about all of them. But it seems that one way or another, many of these things, what they go to is openness, beginning with the idea that if there's you're going to be using a scientific study to make some claim one way or another about a product, whether it is or isn't hazardous, that it ought to be very clear who paid for the study.
That's right. And under not just who paid for it, but under what contract it was done. You know, the leading medical journals, like the New England Journal of Medicine, will no longer publish a study if the first author did that study under a contract that gave the sponsor the right to control the results. In other words, if I run a chemical company and I hire you to do a study, but I say to you, you can't publish it until I give you permission, the leading medical journals say that's not science. That's sort of moving into advocacy, because science has to be complete and transparent. And so this requirement, essentially, that studies be done in a way that whatever the result is, they'll be published, is only required by leading medical journals. The other scientific journals don't require this. And what's even more interesting is that regulatory agencies don't even ask. When a company sends in a study, they don't say who paid for the study, under what contract was it produced. And so the regulators have much more difficulty figuring out, you know, what's the validity of the study.
And one other thing, perhaps, and that is you make the argument that the burden of proof, that is establishing that something is safe, should be on the manufacturer.
It has to be. That's this presumption we've been talking about. That we shouldn't be waiting to, you know, for the body and morgue method, essentially waiting to count the people who are sick, you know, by some public agency before going back to the manufacturer and saying, okay, we see this is dangerous, you've got to do something. The manufacturer should be able to do that beforehand, do all the testing that's necessary before putting something on the market.
And then and perhaps one third thing is that you would, and I'm not sure how exactly this would be accomplished, but you would require that if a manufacturer has information about a product that would suggest that there was a hazard, that they can't keep that secret?
And they're not supposed to now under these same laws, but they do all the time. And it's very important that this get enforced. The other big point I make is that, and it's hard to describe this in just a couple of minutes, but scientists whose work is paid for by sponsors have their views of the science influenced by those payments. It's inevitable. It's human nature. You can't have independent advice by people who aren't independent. And unfortunately, our federal advisory committees and our scientific agencies and even our journals are filled with advice from scientists whose advice is conflicted. And we have example of scientists who probably are honest, who believe their they're giving their honest opinion. But when you look at their opinion, you could see how it's been shaped by this financial relationship, and they end up giving the government and the public very bad advice. And we've paid for this by thousands of heart attacks around Vioxx, for example. So it's very important that when we set up panels to get the advice of scientists, scientists who are working for companies who make those products shouldn't have any role shouldn't have a decision-making role in those panels. They can testify, they can give information, but they shouldn't be giving advice to the public because their views are shaped by that financial relationship.
Our guest for this morning, David Michaels, is research professor and associate chairman in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. He is the author of the book, Doubt Is Their Product, How Industry's Assault on Science Threatens Your Health. It's published by the Oxford University Press. He served as the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Environment, Safety, and Health from 1998 through 2001 and was the chief architect of an initiative to compensate workers in the nuclear weapons complex who were sick, got sick as a result of their work. Dr. Michaels, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, David, for having me on your show.